What does it feel like to grow up in a country where your neighbor might be reporting your breakfast conversations, where a teenage act of rebellion could cost you your freedom, or loving the wrong person could destroy your future? In 1996, an Australian writer arrived in Berlin with a peculiar obsession, what she called a horror romance with the vanished German Democratic Republic. The romance was for their utopian dream, the horror for what they did in its name. She spent years tracking down ordinary people whose lives had been shattered by the Stasi, East Germany's secret police. What emerged wasn't another dry historical account of the Cold War. Instead, it was something far more unsettling. A portrait of how surveillance doesn't just watch you, it rewrites who you are. These aren't stories of famous dissidents or political heroes. They're stories of teenagers, lovers, and parents who made impossible choices in a society where privacy was a crime and trust was a luxury no one could afford. The Runden-Ecke Museum in Leipzig, a former Stasi headquarters, stands frozen in time. Desks sit eerily meet with paired telephones. Broken shredders testify to desperate last-minute destruction. Glass cases display surveillance tools, wigs, fake mustaches, handbags with hidden microphones. Most disturbing are the jars, hundreds containing stolen underwear and clothing scraps. The Stasi collected smell samples to track suspects with dogs, turning the human body into evidence against itself. In a country of 17 million, the Stasi employed 97,000 officers and 173,000 informers, one watcher for every 63 citizens. The Nazi Gestapo had one agent per 2,000 people. The Soviet KGB, one per 5,830. Your teacher, coworker, or spouse might be writing reports about you. In 40 years, they generated records stretching 180 kilometers. They knew who visited you, what you said on the phone, your spouse's affairs. Yet, despite this obsessive detail gathering, they completely failed to predict their own collapse. Merriam-Webber's crime was being 16 and idealistic. In 1968, she and her friend Ursula made protest leaflets using a child's rubber stamp set. Classmates' parents reported them. The Stasi found rubber letters in Merriam's carpet. Both girls spent a month in solitary confinement. No visits, no books, no calls. After release, Merriam decided to run. On New Year's Eve 1968, she boarded a train for Berlin with a borrowed ladder. She surveyed the death strip. Mesh fencing, barbed wire, patrol roads, guard towers, all brightly lit, and began crawling. Miraculously, she made it past several barriers. A guard dog inexplicably didn't attack. 4 meters from freedom, she tripped a wire. After 10 sleepless days of interrogations, she broke and invented an absurd story about meeting a bald man with remarkably small feet who offered help. At trial, the judge claimed her escape attempt could have started World War III. She received 18 months in Stauberg Women's Prison, where she emerged, basically, no longer human. Prison destroyed Merriam. The baptism of welcome at Honeneck, guards repeatedly holding her underwater while screaming insults, left lasting scars. She now removes all doors from her apartments and suffers panic attacks in confined spaces. She eventually met Charlie, a sports teacher who helped her recover. Despite constant Stasi surveillance, they hid books, smuggled photographs, and applied to leave the GDR. In 1980, Charlie was arrested before a visit from West German Chancellor Helmut Schmidt. Then came the knock. A policeman delivered devastating news. Charlie was dead. Major Trost claimed suicide, but his story kept changing. First an elastic waistband, then underwear, then a bedsheet. Merriam was denied access to the body. A document later revealed the Stasi planned cremation the day after burial. The coffin might have been empty. After years of harassment, Merriam was expelled in May 1989, months before the wall fell. Now back in Leipzig, she's still fighting to exhume Charlie's body. She believes guards caused a fatal head injury, then left him to die. Charlie's poem haunts her. "In this land, I have made myself sick with silence." The regime may be gone, but for Merriam, it's not yet over. Julia, a Berlin landlady, initially claimed she had no Stasi story. Then the memories surfaced. At 16, working as an usher at the Leipzig Fair, she met a 30-year-old Italian computer representative. Their relationship lasted 2.5 years, twice yearly visits, annual Hungarian vacations, weekly calls and letters. Police consistently stopped them, checking papers and searching their car. While her boyfriend shook with terror, Julia accepted it as GDR logic, even jokingly saying night all after phone calls, acknowledging potential eavesdroppers. Despite topping her class, Julia was mysteriously sent to a distant, poor reputation boarding school. Later, she inexplicably failed her university entrance exam despite straight A grades. Unable to find work, she fell into depression and broke up with her boyfriend. Then came the summons to meet Major N, who demonstrated complete surveillance of her life, knowing everything about her family, education, and relationships. N wanted Julia to inform on her ex-boyfriend. She refused and vomited after returning home. Then she did something audacious. She wrote a complaint to Erich Honecker himself. Surprisingly, the Stasi backed down. Within a week, Julia had a hotel receptionist job. Years later, she acknowledges the lasting damage. I know how far people will transgress over your boundaries until you have no private sphere left at all. Some stories have no heroes, only impossible choices. When Frau Paul's newborn son Torsten needed life-saving surgery for a ruptured diaphragm, only West Berlin's West End Hospital could help. Then the wall went up in August 1961, trapping Torsten on the other side. Officials refused to let her cross, coldly suggesting, "If your son is as sick as all that, it would be better if he did." After a failed escape attempt, the Pauls were imprisoned. During interrogation, Frau Paul faced an unbearable proposition: visit her critically ill son if she agreed to lure student Michael Hinze into a Stasi kidnapping trap. She refused to become bait in a trap, choosing her principles over seeing her desperately ill child. "I did not make myself guilty. I can sleep at night with what I have done." When the Pauls were bought free in 1964, Torsten came home at nearly 5 years old. "He didn't recognize me as his mother," Frau Paul weeps. "He didn't know what a mother was." Years later, she still struggles. "I decided against my son." When the wall fell on November 9th, it happened almost accidentally. Politburo member Schabowski mistakenly announced immediate travel freedom. Within hours, thousands flooded the barrier that had divided them for 28 years. At Normenenstrasse headquarters, panicked Stasi officers destroyed files until shredders collapsed. When machines failed, they tore documents by hand, systematically placing whole drawers into single bags, enabling future reconstruction. Years later, puzzle women in Nuremberg worked to reconstruct these shredded lives. With 15,000 sacks and workers completing just 10 pages daily, it would take 40 workers 375 years to finish, a Sisyphean joke. Miriam now works at a Leipzig radio station, where some managers are former Stasi informers. When asked to make a program on nostalgia parties, nostalgic GDR-themed events, she refused, explaining these feed a crazy nostalgia for the GDR as if it had been a harmless welfare state. Julia moved to San Francisco, feeling more at home as a foreigner in America than in her native country. Torsten, Frau Paul's son, has grown into a remarkable man despite constant health challenges. When asked about the wall's remnants, he surprises everyone. "I'm happy that it's gone. It would remind me that it could come back." The wall persists mentally, as something former Stasi men hope might return, and as a terrifying possibility for their victims. In a world increasingly comfortable with surveillance, where we carry tracking devices willingly, where algorithms know our preferences before we do, these voices whisper a warning. Privacy isn't just about having secrets. It's about having a self that belongs only to you.